All right, well, thank you very much to the Black Caucus of Health Workers. It is definitely an honor to be invited to present here with you. So much has been covered by my colleagues. There might be some places where I will sort of go through faster because I want to make sure we have plenty of time for questions. Why don't I just start by telling you a little bit about myself and where I come from. I run an organization called Youth Alive. Youth Alive is a homegrown Oakland organization that is involved in violence prevention and intervention in youth leadership. We started with training young people in East Oakland who developed their own strategies and curriculum that they used to then go talk to other peers about why violence was happening, what they could do to prevent it. And then from there, we went on to have programs work directly with young people as well as adults in the community immediately after some type of trauma has occurred. So that could be immediately after incarceration or experiences of violence such as shootings or stabbings or beatings, and also working with the people who are the family and friends of homicide victims. What I'm going to share with you today is observations from that work, and let me just say I know that these are simply observations from the years of our work, and I really welcome feedback and thoughts on these. I do not think that I know everything about it, and so a lot of times I'm just repeating and sharing what's been shared with me, and so I really do welcome feedback on that. Our claim to fame as an organization is that we began the model of hospital-based violence intervention. And after we began that, years later, we got to help some other programs get started. We got to know some of the programs. And so we actually founded something called the National Network of Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs, which I am very proud to say Healing Hurt People and Cure Violence were founding members with us. And so it's a network that we're all part of, and what we try to do is share what we've learned along the way. So what you see there is actually a book that we published with the help of the Office for Victims of Crime. You can download that book for free at the nnhvip.org website if you'd like to, or you could purchase a beautiful bound copy if you'd like. But so a lot of what I'm going to share, and a lot of the wisdom that comes from these colleagues as well as others, is in that book. But I want to tell you a little bit, you know, specifically about our experience in Oakland. So this young man is Sherman Spears. Sherman is a friend and a hero of mine. He, as a young man, was the victim of violence. And after he was shot, that's how he ended up in his wheelchair. That was the moment that his whole life changed. And when he talks about it, he says that he remembers laying in his hospital bed and knowing that his whole life needed to change, that he wanted it to change. But he didn't know how. And the doctors, as Dr. Rich described, were able to care, you know, physically for his wounds, but weren't necessarily trained in how to help him with his needs beyond his medical care, right? With what he was going to do with his life once he got out of the hospital post-discharge. His mother, who was the person who loved and cared for him, was there and wanted to help him, but she was, to be honest, very overwhelmed by the idea that she now had a paraplegic son to care for. And so that took everything she had to do that. His friends were there, and his friends loved him and cared for him, and they offered him the support and help they knew how to give, which is to say, they said, tell us who did it, and we will get him for you. He knew he wanted to find another way, and so he was an extraordinary person. He found his way to Youth Alive and to working with our peer education program, but he never forgot this. And so so in 1993, he said, I want to go back to the hospital, and I want to be, I think, what Charlie would call a credible messenger, right? I want to talk to people about what happened to them, what happened to me, and what their options are. So I know we talk often about this idea that hurt people. I think it's very important to remember also that healed people heal people. And while interruption is an important model for thinking about addressing violence, healing, right, is also another framework, right? Frameworks matter to think about this and the importance of healing. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the model of hospital-based violence intervention. So all the programs share the same thing. We intervene at the golden moment, so that is at the moment of injury or as soon as possible after that to address that trauma. We specifically address retaliation. We offer support pre- and post-discharge, right, including home visits. So our work is not just in the hospital, it's in the field. In fact, the majority of the work actually happens in the field. And then, you know, going back to this credible messenger idea, right, it's a paraprofessional model in a lot of ways. Even when we have people who are professional, they come from the community and can share their experience. The goal of this model is to promote positive alternatives to violence and to reduce retaliation, re-injury, and arrest. And, you know, we started doing this work because Sherman said, I want to talk to these people, and we said, that seems like a great idea. What we didn't know was how effective it actually was. So this is an article that was published in the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery. Dr. Ted Corbin is actually here. He's one of the co-authors of this article. And it's I pointed it out because it's a good summary of the many, many articles that have been published of studies of programs like this. And what they found is that in all these cities where there are programs, Oakland, Baltimore, Chicago, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, San Francisco, the studies have shown reductions in recidivism, right, so fewer returns to the hospital, reductions in arrests, so people that are in this program are less likely to be arrested in the future, reductions in PTSD symptoms, and reductions in emergency care costs. Which is why we titled the article Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs Save Lives and Money. Just because I thought people would be curious, here's a list of all the members, current members of our national network. I assume a lot of you are looking for your city on there. So why intervene at the hospital? Dr. Richin mentioned the statistic, but I want to bring it up again because I think it's staggering. What we know is that people say, well, it's important to work with a high-risk population. Well, we know that if we do nothing, almost half the young people that are coming through our hospitals are going to come back again. Right? And 20% of them are going to die from violence. Sometimes I'll be in a community meeting and I'll point out the statistic and I'll say, why do you think this is the case? Why do you think people that get hurt again? And they'll say, well, they got themselves shot the first time. Which, you know, I think is a common reaction. And I think Charlie did a good job of talking about sort of the media coverage of this issue. And I think Dr. Rich really talked about sort of the problems of the racist frames that are put on this issue, right? And this comes up all the time. People don't get themselves shot, right? But it's interesting to note, and essential to note, that prior victimization is the single most robust predictor of future victimization, right? So I know Charlie talked a lot about how prior victimization really is a great predictor of future perpetration, right? But it's an even better predictor of future victimization. And one of the things when we think about justice, right, not to get off the topic of health, but it's so interesting to think about the most basic thing we should offer people who are victims of violence is to never get hurt again, right? But instead, a lot of our systems make sure that people who are victims of violence don't perpetrate. And I think those two things are actually quite connected. So what I want to share with you is some concepts around the sort of the mechanisms of reinvolvement in violence. And I use that term reinvolvement, right, because this has to do with victimization and perpetration, which for our practical purposes in Oakland is a distinction that is not at all useful. So we just talk about involvement in violence. Right? So if violence is an epidemic, right, which we're talking about today, if violence is an epidemic, the virus is trauma, okay? Dr. Rich pointed out how common PTSD is in communities, but of course, PTSD refers to post-traumatic stress disorder, right? It comes from the idea of a soldier who comes home from the battlefield and is changed by the violence he experienced there. But if you come home, not from the battlefield, but to the battlefield, right? Maybe to the same home where you suffered your injury and there's still bullet holes in the door, there's no post-trauma for you. So it's a really different phenomenon. So this is quite a heavy topic. So I thought it'd be helpful to put it in terms that are more playful. So I thought I'd bring in my friend Grover. And Grover's going to kind of help us think about sort of what are all the ways, right? So this is sort of presenting a concept of like, what are all the ways that we know that violence could potentially happen again? Why is it that someone who's exposed to violence gets exposed again, right? And so Grover always talks about near and far, right? And so I want to talk about the risk factors for violence that are near and far, okay? So we're going to walk through these, but what I want to point out is, while I'm going to talk about all eight of these, it's not like you just have one, right? These risk factors are simultaneous, they interact with each other, and most importantly, they are driven by trauma, okay? So, thinking about immediately after an injury, the most proximate, the nearest risk is that the person who shot you finishes the job, okay? So, it could mean that the patient was the original target, and it's going to continue to be targeted, right? And so, because that was the case, right? And we've actually had this happen, and I shudder to think you probably have had this happen too, right? Where if someone comes into the hospital actually looking for the person they shot. So that's the nearest and closest risk. There's something else that we call pre-retaliation, right? So whether or not the patient was the person who was originally the target, what can happen is that the assailant comes back to attack the patient or the patient's family and friends or their group. And the reason they do this is because they want to get them, even if they didn't originally mean to shoot them, they want to get them now before that person retaliates against them or their friends retaliate against them or talk to the police. Okay. The third closest, proximate risk factor is this idea of current beef escalation. So this is, I think, sort of the classic image that people have when they think about interruption, right? That there's this beef in the community between two groups, right? And so the injury happened as a result of that, and now because, we were already having a conflict about whatever, turf or a girl or something, now it's stepped up, right? So now we're going to retaliate, and so this conflict that we have is being escalated to another level. What's interesting about this can happen, right, whether or not the person who was injured was even the target, right? Because, as often happens, and that's why we named our program, a lot of people are caught in the crossfire. But the notion that, well, I wasn't in this beef, but now I am in it, can happen. And so the patient now is in danger, right, because there's a retaliation cycle that's begun. Now, there may have not have been any existing beef. The person may literally have been shot not accidentally or for no reason or not the intended target. So what happens is the patient then, or a family member or friend, retaliates, right, because they're upset that this happened, even if they didn't have a conflict with who did it before. And this is often taken out on a, perceived assailant, right? So it could be that they correctly identified who it was that shot them, or it could be they incorrectly identified it, but whatever it is, that desire for revenge comes out, and so now where there hadn't been a conflict, right, where this person was not involved, now there's an involvement. So then we see this escalation, right, where there hadn't been a conflict or a beef before, there's a new one. Dangerous choices. So Dr. Rich covered an example of this, but what this means is, because of the trauma that happened to you, because of the violence, the patient, right, you're now making choices that put you in harm's way. So you could be carrying a weapon now that you weren't carrying before because you don't feel safe, and this is now something that you want to do to feel safe. Well, as our youth leaders always tell other youth when they're talking to them, actually carrying a weapon, right, and you're public health professionals, you know this, makes you much, much more likely to become a victim of violence, right? It actually increases your chances. Another example of a dangerous choice is people now choose to join a gang, right, to feel safe, right? They weren't in a gang before, but now they think, well, if I had been, I would have been protected. Or if I was sort of more serious about being in the gang, or wasn't sort of peripheral, but like really got deep in the gang, I'd be safer. So those are examples of choices, right, that you make that maybe doesn't mean tomorrow you're going to be involved in violence, but escalates your risk tremendously for being involved in violence. All right, so dangerous reactions. So what this means is, as a result of the traumatic incident, you have PTSD-related symptoms. Even if you don't have full-blown PTSD, you could have any of the symptoms of it. And some of these put you in harm's way. So impulsivity can lead to conflict escalation, right? So so now you're carrying a weapon, which you didn't carry before, right? Now you're hyper-aroused, fight or flight all the time. Now someone brushes up against you, and you think they're going to start something, and you react, right? There's a conflict where there hadn't been a conflict before. Another common thing we see is the numbness that happens after a traumatic incident has occurred, right, as part of PTSD. So you might lose the ability to access certain feelings. One of the feelings that you often lose, we found, is people lose fear. They don't feel fear the same way anymore. And so situations that you might have avoided before because you were scared, you don't even register, right, as something to be fearful of. So so you go toward a conflict that you wouldn't have gone toward before. So that's an example of type of reactions you might have. Re-experiencing, reenactment, right? That can be a dangerous reaction that gets you into trouble. And just in general, what's really difficult about the sort of low level of fight or flight or reaction that you have all the time in your body means, you know, we lose our ability to really distinguish real threats from perceived threats, which means real threats we might not perceive as real and then we're in them, or things that aren't really a threat we react to as if they are, right? So you can see just how that experience, and so often we'll find people that are involved in violence again simply because of the reactions. Risky behaviors. So I think this is something that Dr. Rich also covered when he talked about, for example, using marijuana, right? So there are certain behaviors that we know are correlated with increased risk for violence, like increased drug and alcohol use, like failure to attend school or work, that we know are correlated with reactions to trauma, okay? So if you are suffering PTSD symptoms and you can't focus very well, you're going to do very poorly in school, you're going to be frustrated about going, okay? You may not go. If you can't sleep at night, you might sleep through, right, your alarm to actually get up and go to work, right, or function so poorly when you get there. So there's behaviors that we're seeing that are they're caused, right, by how you're reacting to trauma and violence, that then lead to these things that we know, right, are put you at risk for future involvement, right? If you can't do well, if you can't keep a job, if you can't stay in school, if you're using drugs, alcohol, these things are all correlated with risk for violence. And then the final factor I want to talk about is just the environment. Environment itself can be dangerous. So even if you aren't exhibiting all these different symptoms and behaviors, if you live in a dangerous environment, you could get robbed, you know, you could get caught in the crossfire anyway. And so sometimes, and this is just a sad truth, right, is that we'll see people come back to the hospital and it will literally have nothing to do with their initial trip to the hospital. You know, I was struck one time, we had a young man who was just riding the bus and was stabbed by a gentleman who was not well. And the hospital came and said, "What happened? I thought you were working with this guy." So we can't control public transit and who gets on and off it, right? This is you know, as hard as we try. So I want to talk a little bit just, and I'll finish up very fast, but just an example of a case study, because I was thinking about, you know, how we often talk about how great these programs are and all their successes, and so I thought it would be interesting, if somewhat embarrassing, to talk about really one of our struggles. So this is a young man that I recently saw again, so we can call him Joe. He was in our program. He, as a 16-year-old, was robbed and shot and ended up in the hospital. He, at the time, was not involved in a gang but had been recruited. But the robbery had nothing to do with that. We worked with him for a year. We helped him recover physically. We supported him to go back to school. He graduated high school. We enrolled him in college. He went to, in addition to having a counselor, a paraprofessional, you know, an intervention specialist, we called him, who worked with him very closely and, you know, drove him back and forth to appointments and took him out to lunch. We also had him enrolled in mental health services. So we actually had a mental health counselor that would go meet him wherever he was and work on what he was dealing with. And so this felt like a success. But I ran into him again a couple weeks ago, and he's now on probation. He was having nightmares and paranoia. He said, "I know I should have known better, because I used to tell people not to carry a weapon, but I felt the need to start carrying a weapon," which is how he got his probation case. His mental health has decompensated, and we had to warn others that we worked with that he was now a danger to himself and others in terms of his behavior, and we have been working very hard to sort of drop by and court him back to care and support. But to be honest, it's touch and go, and it breaks my heart that it had been a year since we saw him and it hadn't stuck. So sort of in summary, I think we're just going back to the idea, right, that these are health, violence is a health problem, so we need a health solution, and that trauma is really important when we think about that, and how trauma is wrapped up in all kinds of behaviors. And just a quick example of that, I won't go into detail on it, but we did some work actually with Dr. Corbin and Dr. Rich to say, how can we, you know, think of health solutions, and how can we develop a health tool? So one thing we did is we said, you know, let's stop diagnosing people without treating them, partly because overdiagnosis is a pathologizing people, particularly those most affected by violence, which is to say young black and brown males, has been a real tragedy of the health system. So we said, what can we do that if we see someone, at least gives them some help, right? So someone walks away not feeling like they know what's wrong with them, but they have some hope. And so we developed something we call the Screening and Tool for Awareness and Relief of Trauma. This is something we developed with a series of focus groups and then surveys with young men that we'd work with who were themselves gunshot victims about what was helpful to them in their recovery. And so I won't go into the details of it, but suffice it to say, it's a 15 to 30 minute intervention that addresses some actual practical needs, like if you can't sleep, how do you make an effort to sleep better? All right, thank you very much.